History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold if we'll do something about it. Time is of the essence, of course, but if we'll take the initiative to ask a few questions and care enough to patiently listen to the responses that start to trickle out, we might just hear something that really adds to our perspective. The idea here is, first of all, to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And when we do that, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. With our next episode, we're going to return to our usual format of one veteran story from start to finish, but there were a couple of significant events this week, nearly 5,000 miles apart, that you may not have heard about. Both of them commemorating something very important that took place 76 years ago. While the headlines over the last week were dominated by Afghanistan and U.S. forces leaving after 20 years, the complications, challenges, and differing views arising from how that was handled, this last week also marked the 76th anniversary of the official end of a war that didn't last nearly that long, but embroiled the entire world in the deadliest conflict humanity has ever known. September 2nd, 1945 was the day that officials from the U.S. and Japan met on the battleship USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay to sign the Instruments of Surrender that brought World War II to an end. Over the years, we've heard countless veterans share their stories here, and we've heard why that day was so important. But with each successive anniversary, there are fewer and fewer of those World War II veterans still with us to tell the story. This past Thursday at the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., there were four guests of honor at the official commemoration of the 76th anniversary of the end of the war. Four World War II veterans who all participated in a wreath laying in front of the memorial's Freedom Wall, where 4,000 gold stars signify the more than 400,000 Americans who died while serving in World War II. Before we're done today, we're going to hear audio from some of America's leaders 76 years ago, but first, let's hear the keynote remarks from this week's commemoration at the National World War II Memorial, where the sound of the memorial's centerpiece fountain is always audible behind any speaker, and you may even hear a siren or two racing past the National Mall in Washington. But the words of retired Army General Mick Kicklighter underscored why September 2nd, 1945 is such a significant date to remember.
On this morning, 76 years ago, September the 2nd, 1945, General Douglas MacArthur, supported by Admiral Chester Nimitz and Admiral Bull Halsey and other senior American and Allied military leaders, received 9 Japanese representatives aboard the fleet's flagship, USS Missouri, anchored in Tokyo Bay. 2 copies of the surrender were signed at a small desk on the deck of the Missouri by representatives of each of the Allied nations and the 8 representatives of Japan. That surrender officially marked the end of the war in the Pacific, which brought an end to the most destructive war in history, World War II, where more than 60 million people lost their lives, mostly women, children, and the elderly, who got overrun by that war. Millions were murdered in death camps and concentration camps. And those we honor today won that war, and I might say, against great odds, and not only saved this nation, but they literally, with our allies, saved the world. Thank you all for joining us to help us remember to thank and to honor our World War II veterans. This is a time that we come together to reflect, to remember, and to rededicate ourselves to ensure that we, going forward, preserve this great gift of freedom. And their service and sacrifice will not have been in vain. A special thanks also to the World War II veterans that are with us today. They are our truly our honored guests. Your service and your dedication and your sacrifice made that victory possible 76 years ago. And they're really not words that are adequate or strong enough or appropriate to really say thank you for your service. Thank you for this great nation that you gave us. When that war ended, these veterans came home. Most took off their uniform. Some remained in service to continue to serve. And they said very little about what they'd accomplished in the war. They rolled up their sleeves. Some went back to school on the GI Bill. But together, they built this strong, free, and beautiful America that we're privileged to live in every day. That precious gift came at a very high price. And we're reminded of that price as you look behind me at the wall of the gold stars that represent more than 400,000 young Americans who never came home. They gave all their tomorrows for that great gift of freedom that we should never take for granted. And when you're only 18 or 19 or 20 years old, as most were that are on that wall, all your tomorrows is a very high price to pay. This monument, a gift from the people of this great nation, says in a very special way, and this ceremony says in a very special way, that your service and your sacrifice will never be forgotten. God bless all of our veterans that are with us today. God bless all the World War II veterans still with us across this nation, their families, and especially the Gold Star families. God bless America, and thank you for coming this morning.
Again, that was retired Army General Mick Kicklider at this past Thursday's 76th anniversary commemoration of the end of World War II at the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. We're going to hear an excerpt from another observation nearly 5,000 miles west of there in a bit. But if you ever visit the National World War II Memorial, you will find a quote etched in stone from President Harry Truman. Our debt to the heroic men and valiant women in the service of our country can never be repaid, he said. They have earned our undying gratitude. America will never forget their sacrifice. On some of these very same radio airwaves 76 years ago, President Truman addressed the nation, emphasizing the importance of what was happening on the battleship Missouri, looking back over the 4 years of war the nation had endured, and also looking forward to the kind of future he was hoping and praying for.
My fellow Americans, Supreme Allied Commander General MacArthur, and Allied representatives on the battleship Missouri in Tokyo Bay, the thoughts and hopes of all America, indeed of all the civilized world, are centered tonight on the battleship Missouri. There, on that small piece of American soil, anchored in Tokyo Harbor, the Japanese have just officially laid down their arms. They have signed terms of unconditional surrender. 4 years ago, the thoughts and fears of the whole civilized world were centered on another piece of American soil, Pearl Harbor. The mighty threat to civilization which began there is now laid at rest. It was a long road to Tokyo and a bloody one. We shall not forget Pearl Harbor. The Japanese militarists will not forget the USS Missouri. The evil done by the Japanese warlords can never be repaired or forgotten. But their power to destroy and kill has been taken from them. Their armies, and what is left of their navy, are now impotent. To all of us, there comes first a sense of gratitude to Almighty God, who sustained us and our allies in the dark days of grave danger, who made us to grow from weakness into the strongest fighting force in history, and who has now seen us overcome the forces of tyranny that sought to destroy his civilization. God grant that in our pride of this hour, we may not forget the hard tasks that are still before us, that we may approach these with the same courage, zeal, and patience with which we faced the trials and problems of the past 4 years. Our first thoughts, of course, thoughts of gratefulness and deep obligation, go out to those of our loved ones who have been killed or maimed in this terrible war. On land and sea and in the air, American men and women have given their lives so that this day of ultimate victory might come and assure the survival of a civilized world. No victory can make good their loss. We think of those whom death in this war has hurt, taking from them fathers, husbands, sons, brothers and sisters whom they love. No victory can bring back the faces they long to see. Only the knowledge that the victory, which these sacrifices have made possible, will be wisely used, can give them any comfort. It is our responsibility, ours the living, to see to it that this victory shall be a monument worthy of the dead who died to win it. All millions of men and women in our armed forces and merchant marines, all over the world, who, after years of sacrifice and hardship and peril, have been spared by Providence from harm. We think of all the men and women and children who, during these years, have carried on at home in lonesomeness and anxiety and fear. Our thoughts go out to the millions of American workers and businessmen, to our farmers and miners, to all those who have built up this country's fighting strength and who have shipped to our allies the means to resist and overcome the enemy. Our thoughts go out to our civil servants and to the thousands of Americans who, at personal sacrifice, have come to serve in our government during these trying years, to the members of the Selective Service Boards and Ration Boards, to the Civilian Defense and Red Cross workers, to the men and women in the USO and in the entertainment world, to all those who have helped in this cooperative struggle to preserve liberty and decency in the world. We think of our departed gallant leader, Franklin D. Roosevelt, defender of democracy, architect of world peace and cooperation. And our thoughts go out to our gallant allies in this war, to those who resisted the invaders, to those who were not strong enough to hold out, but who, nevertheless, kept the fires of resistance alive within the souls of their people, to those who stood up against great odds and held the line until the United Nations together were able to supply the arms and the men with which to overcome the forces of evil. This is a victory of more than arms alone. This is a victory of liberty over tyranny. From our war plants rolled the tanks and planes which blasted their way to the heart of our enemy. From our shipyards sprang the ships which bridged all the oceans of the world for our weapons and supplies. From our farms came the food and fiber for our armies and navies and for our allies in all the corners of the earth. From our mines and factories came the raw materials and the finished products which gave us the equipment to overcome our enemy. But back of it all were the will and spirit and determination of a free people who know what freedom is and who know that it is worth whatever price they had to pay to preserve it. It was the spirit of liberty which gave us our armed strength and which made our men invincible in battle. We now know that that spirit of liberty, the freedom of the individual, and the personal dignity of man are the strongest and toughest and most enduring forces in all the world. And so on VJ Day, we take renewed faith and pride in our own way of life. We have had our day of rejoicing over this victory. We have had our day of prayer and devotion. Now let us set aside VJ Day as one of renewed consecration to the principles which have made us the strongest nation on earth and which, in this war, we have striven so mightily to preserve. Those principles provide the faith, the hope, and the opportunity which help men to improve themselves and their lot. Liberty does not make all men perfect, nor all society secure, but it has provided more solid progress and happiness and decency for more people than any other philosophy of government in history. And this day has shown again that it provides the greatest strength and the greatest power which man has ever reached. We know that under it we can meet the hard problems of peace which have come upon us. A free people with free allies who can develop an atomic bomb can use the same skill and energy and determination to overcome all the difficulties ahead. Victory always has its burdens and its responsibilities as well as its rejoicings. But we face the future and all its dangers with great confidence and great hope. America can build for itself a future of employment and security. Together with the United Nations, it can build a world of peace founded on justice, fair dealing, and tolerance. As President of the United States, I proclaim Sunday, September the 2nd, 1945, to be VJ Day, the day of the formal surrender of Japan. It is not yet the day for the formal proclamation of the end of the war, nor of the cessation of hostilities, but it is a day which we Americans shall always remember as a day of retribution, as we remember that other day, the day of infamy. From this day, we move forward. We move toward a new era of security at home. With the other United Nations, we move toward a new and better world of cooperation, of peace, and international goodwill. God's help has brought us to this day of victory. With His help, we will attain that peace and prosperity for ourselves and all the world in the years ahead.
President Harry Truman, 76 years ago, on September 2nd, 1945. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, what General Douglas MacArthur and Admiral Chester Nimitz had to say from the deck of the battleship Missouri on that historic day, and a ceremony aboard the Mighty Mo this week with a story of one American's effort to make sure a very special and historic flag was present for the surrender. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. In a week, our nation will pause to recognize the 20th anniversary of September 11th, 2001, and all those who perished in New York and the Pentagon and in a field in Pennsylvania. But this week, overshadowed by headlines about Afghanistan and COVID-19, were ceremonies both in Washington, D.C. and at Pearl Harbor, commemorating the 76th anniversary of the end of World War II. September 2nd was a significant day for all Americans and certainly for people all over the world. But no one appreciated the war's end quite like those who had spent years in captivity as prisoners of war. Here's another date to remember and mark on your calendar. The third Friday in September every year is National POW/MIA Day, honoring prisoners of war and those still missing in action. That falls on September 17th this year. There's likely an observance in your local area that you may want to attend. But for perspective on what victory over Japan and the end of World War II really meant, I want you to hear how Bill Overmyer remembered it. Bill passed away last month at the age of 101 in his beloved Albuquerque, New Mexico. By this time, 76 years ago, he had spent more than 3 years as a prisoner of Imperial Japan.
One day after work, the commandant, who was we found out that he was a principal at the high school, and he spoke a little English. And we went into the mess hall, just the officers and the non-commissioned officers. And he got up in front, he said, "Peace is smiling." We said, "What'd you say?" "Peace is smiling, goo. The war is over, goo." Hallelujah. That place went up in smoke. He said, "Don't tell the men. Keep it quiet, please." We said, "Yes, we will." Until we got out the door, and we told everybody else as quick as we could.
How do you keep that news to yourself, right?
Anyway, then here came B-29s. "What the heck are they doing this close? Oh, they're dropping parachutes. Oh, that's a 55-gallon drum. Oh, it dropped right in the rice field right outside our camp. A camp of 55 drums of cocoa, 55 drums of sugar, lard, anything else." Boy, we started eating like you can't believe. And I slept next to Cy Serrata. He was in the 31st Infantry at Yokohama. Right, I could touch him every night on a straw mattress. And he had gone with us, of course. He was up on a roof. One of those 55 guns hit him on the head.
Oh.
Survived 3 years, and he got, at least he didn't suffer.
Here they're dropping supplies to try to keep you alive, and it kills him on the roof.
The chute didn't open.
Wow.
That didn't happen very often, but it did happen.
How tragic.
It did happen. I think I was lucky. I was fortunate in the outcome of everything that happened. Mainly, I didn't stick my neck out. We had a saying in camp, "Don't stick your ears out or anything out and do anything contrary to what the Japs don't like or do like." So that's what happened. And I didn't, you know, the Army term for seeking approval from a higher up. We didn't do that.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Anyway, we did what we had to do to survive. And you just take it day by day. I learned at Yokohama how little it takes to survive, to live, day after day. You need food. That's a question mark. You need a roof over your head. You need clothes to survive against the elements, and maybe friendship. There wasn't that much of it, but books or peace of mind that you could manufacture or whatever. That's about all you need. You don't need all this fancy living. When we were liberated from Sendai, we got on the train. And we got the same train that brought us down, and we went up to Yokohama train station. We'd passed it every day, twice. And there was American soldiers, officers, and nurses. We saw our first American nurses and workers and so forth. They sure look good, I'll tell you.
That was the late Bill Overmyer explaining what the end of World War II meant to him and other American prisoners of war in September 1945. Meanwhile, on the deck of the USS Missouri, General Douglas MacArthur had his unique way of putting things in perspective. We're going to hear his remarks now from that day, as you would have heard him on the radio 76 years ago, followed by the sentiments of Admiral Chester Nimitz.
"My fellow countrymen, today the guns are silent. A great tragedy has ended. A great victory has been won. The skies no longer rain death. The seas bear only commerce. Men everywhere walk upright in the sunlight. The entire world lies quietly at peace. The holy mission has been completed. And in reporting this to you, the people, I speak for the thousands of silent lips forever stilled among the jungles and the beaches and in the deep waters of the Pacific, which mark the way. I speak for the unnamed brave millions homeward bound to take up the challenge of that future which they did so much to salvage from the brink of disaster. As I look back on the long, tortuous trail from those grim days of Bataan and Corregidor, when an entire world lived in fear, when democracy was on the defensive everywhere, when modern civilization trembled in the balance, I thank a merciful God that he has given us the faith, the courage, and the power from which to mold victory. We have known the bitterness of defeat and the exaltation of triumph. And from both, we have learned there can be no turning back. We must go forward to preserve in peace what we won in war. A new era is upon us. Even the lesson of victory itself brings it profound concern, both for our future security and the survival of civilization. The destructiveness of the war potential through progressive advances in scientific discovery has, in fact, now reached a point which revises the traditional concept of war. Men, since the beginning of time, have sought peace. Various methods through the ages have been attempted to devise an international process to prevent or settle disputes between nations. From the very start, workable methods were found insofar as individual citizens were concerned. But the mechanics of an instrumentality of larger international scope have never been successful. Military alliances, balances of power, leagues of nations, all in turn failed, leaving the only path to be by way of the crucible of war. The utter destructiveness of war now blots out this alternative. We have had our last chance. If we do not devise some greater and more equitable system, Armageddon will be at our door. The problem, basically, is theological and involves a spiritual recrudescence and improvement of human character that will synchronize with our almost matchless advance in science, art, literature, and all material and cultural developments of the past 2,000 years. It must be of the spirit if we are to save the flesh. We stand in Tokyo today, reminiscent of our countryman, Commodore Perry, 92 years ago. His purpose was to bring to Japan an era of enlightenment and progress by lifting the veil of isolation to the friendship, trade, and commerce of the world. But alas, the knowledge thereby gained of Western science was forged into an instrument of oppression and human enslavement. Freedom of expression, freedom of action, even freedom of thought were denied through suppression of liberal education, through appeal to superstition, and through the application of force. We are committed by the Potsdam Declaration of Principles to see that the Japanese people are liberated from this condition of slavery. It is my purpose to implement this commitment just as rapidly as the armed forces are demobilized and other essential steps taken to neutralize the war potential. The energy of the Japanese race, if properly directed, will enable expansion vertically rather than horizontally. If the talents of the race are turned into constructive channels, the country can lift itself from its present deplorable state into a position of dignity. To the Pacific Basin has come the vista of a new emancipated world. Today, freedom is on the offensive. Democracy is on the march. Today, in Asia as well as in Europe, unshackled peoples are tasting the full sweetness of liberty, the relief from fear. In the Philippines, America has evolved a model for this new free world of Asia. In the Philippines, America has demonstrated that peoples of the East and peoples of the West may walk side by side in mutual respect and with mutual benefit. The history of our sovereignty there has now the full confidence of the East. And so, my fellow countrymen, today I report to you that your sons and daughters have served you well and faithfully with the calm, deliberate, determined fighting spirit of the American soldier and sailor, based upon a tradition of historical trait as against the fanaticism of an enemy supported only by mythological fiction. Their spiritual strength and power has brought us through to victory. They are homeward bound. Take care of them.
That was General of the Army Douglas MacArthur, Supreme Commander of the Allied Powers. We will now hear Fleet Admiral Chester W. Nimitz, United States Navy, the Commander-in-Chief of the United States Pacific Fleet.
On board all naval vessels at sea and in port and at our many island bases in the Pacific, there is rejoicing and thanksgiving. The long and bitter struggle which Japan started so treacherously on the 7th of December, 1941, is at an end. I take great pride in the American forces which have helped to win this victory. America can be proud of them. The officers and men of the United States Army, Navy, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, and Merchant Marine who fought in the Pacific have written heroic new chapters in this nation's military history. I have infinite respect for their courage, resourcefulness, and devotion to duty. We also acknowledge the great contribution to this victory made by our valiant allies. United we fought, and united we prevail. The port of Tokyo, which was first opened by Commodore Perry in 1853, is now crowded with United States men of war. The process of bringing Japan into the family of civilized nations, which was interrupted when Japan launched her program of conquest, will soon begin again. Today, all freedom-loving peoples of the world rejoice in the victory and feel pride in the accomplishments of our combined forces. We also pay tribute to those who defended our freedom at the cost of their lives. On Guam is a military cemetery in a green valley not far from my headquarters. The ordered rows of white crosses stand as reminders of the heavy cost we have paid for victory. On these crosses are the names of American soldiers, sailors, and Marines: Culpepper, Tomino, Sweeney, Bromberg, Depew, Malloy, Ponziani, names that are a cross-section of democracy. They fought together as brothers in arms. They died together, and now they sleep side by side. To them, we have a solemn obligation. The obligation to ensure that their sacrifice will help to make this a better and safer world in which to live. To achieve this, it will be necessary for the United Nations to enforce rigidly the peace terms that will be imposed upon Japan. It will also be necessary to maintain our national strength at a level which will discourage future acts of aggression aimed at the destruction of our way of life. Now we turn to the great task of reconstruction and restoration. I am confident that we will be able to apply the same skill, resourcefulness, and keen thinking to these problems as were applied to the problems of winning the victory.
Admiral Chester Nimitz, and before him, General Douglas MacArthur from the battleship USS Missouri on September 2nd, 1945. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, a story you may not have heard about the lengths to which one American went to ensure that a very special flag was present on the Mighty Mo for that historic occasion. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you're a business owner, I've got a phone number you really ought to take down, 800-989-1139. And when I say business owner, I mean businesses of all shapes and sizes, from the multinational chain to the hot dog stand on the corner, or my personal preference, the taco truck, 800-989-1139. Because you can have the greatest product or service in the world, the best business plan, the most capable workforce, and still not maximize your potential if you don't have a reliable, efficient, and versatile plan for processing payments. 800-989-1139. That's the number for my friends at Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in the country. Why is Provident growing so fast? Because they're committed to helping your business grow. 800-989-1139. That nonprofit you love that relies on donations? Provident can even connect you to a special software platform to streamline and stimulate giving. If you are ready to grow, give it a go. Go Provident today at providentpayments.com or call that number, 800-989-1139.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our special episode marking 76 years since the official end of World War II. Observances were held this week at both the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. and aboard the battleship USS Missouri in Pearl Harbor. In a moment, we're going to hear a very unique story shared at the event on the Missouri, which was in Tokyo Bay 76 years ago for the signing of the Instruments of Surrender that finally brought World War II to a close. But before that, let's hear from a man who knows Pearl Harbor very well. Mickey Ganich is now 101 years old. He was a 21-year-old aboard the USS Pennsylvania at Pearl Harbor when the war began for America, and he was still on the battleship Pennsylvania for the war's final month.
Something happened August 6th of 1945. It dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima. 3 days later, August 9th, it dropped an atomic bomb on Nagasaki. 3 days later, August 12th, we got in Okinawa. All the other ships are in there. We anchored in there. 8:30 that night, Japanese plane came on with its lights on. Nobody fired a shot at it. They thought it's a friendly plane. Aimed its torpedo at the coast of the big ship it saw, battleship Pennsylvania. The living compartment, the quartermaster's, is back by the rudder, back by the propellers. That's where the living compartment was. Half hour before that, I went up the bridge. I was going to write a letter to one of my sisters. 8:30 at night, when that Japanese plane came in, launched that torpedo, it hit the propellers back there. Everything went in and up. The living compartment, the quartermasters, that 26 quartermasters, I lost 20 of them that night. The next morning, Japanese asked for peace. We're trying to stay afloat while we signed the peace treaty in Tokyo Bay. They told us in the shallow ground, so if we sink, we'll just sink in the mud. We'll say we'll stay afloat. We got hit at Pearl Harbor, never got hit again till the night before Japanese asked for peace.
And if I'm understanding you correctly, had you not gone above to write the letter to your sister, you would have been in there where the torpedo hit.
Yeah. I forgot I had other plans for me there, too.
And in this case, those 20 men who were killed were guys you had come to know very well.
I knew them. I knew them by their first names there. And being on the ship there and knowing them by their first names, they worked for me and I knew them. And one of my jobs is to identify bodies and parts of bodies here. I hope I never have to go through something like that again, identifying by the clothing, the stencils on their clothing and names there, trying to identify them and collect their gear and send it home to their families. In fact, one of my first class, the one that was next one under me, I took his clothes back to his folks back in Wisconsin there. Mm. That was hard to do.
I can't imagine anything more difficult. I mean, what do you say in a situation like that?
And when the ship got torpedoed there at Okinawa, it sunk so far down in the back part of the ship where you could step right on the water. Four bodies were recovered that morning, first thing. Divers went down and pulled guys over close. I grabbed a hold of one guy's arm and I pulled his arm back out of his socket. That's awfully hard to do.
And when it's so close to the end of the war.
Yeah.
How should those guys be remembered all these years later?
By treating each other like they treated you. They were alive. We had treated each other respectfully, lovingly, try to be friends with everybody. I think that would be a plus if the people would know it.
You know, and I've talked to so many veterans for whom VJ Day was a day of celebration, and they were excited. Here, the war is finally over. But it sounds like for your ship, that must have been bittersweet considering what had just happened.
Yeah. It told us to Guam, which is the war's over. They're already signed, and we're still sitting there. And it told us to Guam there. And during the period from Okinawa to Guam, because the floating dry dock down there, it told us that three tugs pulled us there because we didn't have any power at that time. So the war was, the peace treaty was being signed. We got in Guam, put us in a floating dry dock, and recovered many we can of the bodies and all. And we got patched up, and they sent us back to the States. The war is over. They sent back to the States. We got about 300-400 miles east of Guam. Well, we had to, when the torpedo hit, it wiped out the propellers on the right side. One on the left side was good, and one was not so good. About 300-400 miles east of Guam there, we started having problems with the propeller. So we stopped the ship. We were all by ourselves. The war is over there, and everybody else went in their different directions there. We stopped the ship, put divers on the other side, see what they could do. Because in all big ships, you have divers. We put divers on the other side, see what they can do with that propeller. Meantime, sharks were attracted by parts of bodies that are still on the ship there. We pulled the divers out of the water, put boats in the water with the Marines here with rifles to keep the sharks away from the divers so they could work on the propeller. So we came back to was able to get back to the States by ourselves with one propeller out of four.
And if they hadn't been able to repair that one, what would have happened to you guys? You were dead in the water, huh?
We'd be out there like the Indianapolis, the one that took the atomic bomb there to Tinian for bombing over Japan there. We'd been in bad shape, but fortunes of the war, I guess, well, that's what you'd call it. And this was September 2nd, they signed the peace treaty in on the Missouri in Tokyo Bay. So it's quite a relief now we can get back to normal there if we can. And think about what happened there and think about the future, what's going to happen.
That really was the significance of September 2nd, 1945, closing a chapter of a painful past that opened the door to an unknown future. Mickey Gannich hopes to be in Pearl Harbor for the 80th anniversary of the Day of Infamy come December. But this week at Pearl Harbor, as dignitaries gathered aboard the battleship that was in Tokyo Bay 76 years ago, the USS Missouri, historian Daniel Martinez shared the story of one American's determination to make sure one very special item was present for the occasion all those years ago.
Recently, I ran across an article written by Michael Ruane of the Washington Post. It was a story that I was not familiar with. It's about a flag that was needed to be carried by a Navy courier to the surrender site somewhere in Japan. And the young officer that was tasked to carry it, his name was Lieutenant John Bremier. His mission was urgent. Bremier, age 25, was to carry a flag from Washington and travel on anything that would get him in a hurry to the legendary Admiral William F. Bull Halsey, then on the battleship USS Missouri, somewhere in the Pacific. With him was this old wool American flag in a wooden box stowed in a courier's bag. And Lieutenant Bremier knew he had to keep it close by. He would take it with him when he went to the bathroom, when he went to eat, when he slept, and he would stay with it every minute of the 9,000-mile journey. Exactly where, he didn't know. Japan had just surrendered to the Allies, but the formal surrender ceremony that would end World War II had not yet been held. And Halsey wanted the flag present for the solemn event, which we now know was going to be held in Tokyo Bay. The flag was worn and begrimed with age, almost a century old. It had linen backing to support it. There were holes in the stripes, and the 31 stars were arranged unevenly. But the flag had been in Japan before, when it was taken ashore and raised outside Yokohama in 1853 by Navy Commodore Matthew Perry. The mission was a success, and the flag became a treasured piece of the history of the U.S. Naval Academy. But Perry's exploit had been 92 years before, and when told he was carrying the Perry flag, Bremer said, "What's that?" Well, it didn't matter. He had to get across the country in the Pacific Ocean fast. Halsey was waiting for it. The ceremony aboard the USS Missouri, the gigantic battleship, would be in Tokyo Bay, and it was scheduled for 9 a.m. on Sunday, September 2nd, 3 years and 9 months since Sunday morning of December 7th, 1941. But the flag was going to get there. Lieutenant Bremer had to hurry. Bremer was the son of a World War I veteran who had been gassed in combat, had left his law studies at the University of Kansas to join naval service in 1942. The Navy accepted him even though he was colorblind and never had set eyes on the ocean. He was eventually assigned to the Navy's top secret courier system and had a top secret security clearance. In August of 1945, he was stationed at the Officer Messenger Mail Center in the main Navy complex on the Mall, where Constitution Gardens is located today. The war was essentially over. It had been a week since Emperor Hirohito had announced Japan's surrender. Nazi Germany had given up in May. On Thursday, August 23rd, he went to work as usual. The day was winding down when the orders came from Halsey. The flag was rushed from the Naval Academy in Annapolis, and Bremer was instructed, quote, "Proceed immediately." But he hadn't even packed his clothes yet. His roommate brought him some clothes, and by 7 p.m., he was at the new Washington National Airport with the flag. The next plane going out was a cargo plane with no passenger seats. It was cold aloft, quote, "like sitting on a pie pan," he remembered. He wrapped himself in a blanket and rested on a pile of mail sacks. Hours passed as the plane flew west and reached San Francisco the next afternoon, August 24th. On the other side of the world, the USS Missouri and the ships of Halsey's Third Fleet were approaching Japan's Sagami Bay, just outside Tokyo Bay. Meanwhile, Bremer was on his way. He was exhausted and hungry. He grabbed some pancakes and a sandwich in Winslow, Arizona, and then another sandwich and a glass of tomato juice in San Francisco. At about 3 p.m. that afternoon, he boarded a Navy passenger plane for the 12-hour hop to Pearl Harbor. The plane was a plush job, he recalled, with carpets and nice seats, orderlies, served food, and again, it was sandwiches. He landed at the Naval Air Station here in Pearl Harbor, Honolulu, in the wee hours of Saturday, August 25th. He needed a shave, some sleep, and a decent meal. Quote, "I was pretty tired, not having my pants off since Thursday morning," he recalled. He asked if he could lay over and get a while and get cleaned up. "Nope," he was told, you got to get through. There was a plane headed for Guam in 90 minutes. The plane took off and flew 4 hours to Johnston Island, a one-strip air base, and then about 900 miles southwest of Hawaii. An hour later, the plane took off, and this time it was an 8-hour, 1,500 leg to Kwajalein, a sun-blasted Pacific atoll the Americans had seized from the Japanese in the bloody fighting in 1944. A brief stop for more pancakes, two hot dogs. He then took off for Guam 10 hours away. Quote, "I still hadn't had any clean clothes or a shower or shave since leaving Washington. A total of 59 hours had elapsed and I was damn tired." He reached Guam late that night. He wasn't sure what to do next. Quote, "My instructions had been effect of delivering the flag," he recalled, "but where was he to find Halsey? And should he hand the flag off to someone else?" Then he got the word. Halsey was on a battleship, 1,500 miles away and waiting for his flag. There was a plane taking off the next morning for Iwo Jima, which would get him halfway there. He got some sleep, the flag still at his side. In the morning, he had a shave and he put on some clean clothes and headed for Iwo Jima on a transport plane. It was now August 28th. Things were beginning to unfold, and Bremer was worried about making it in time. At Iwo Jima, he asked Navy officials about getting to Tokyo, and he was told it would take 2 days. Well, that was cutting it pretty close. He asked around and found an Army-Navy outfit that flew search and rescue planes. The pilots said they could drop him off at the Missouri the next day. On August 29th, the seaplane took off and landed late in the afternoon in the very rough water of Sagami Bay. The USS Missouri sent a boat to get Bremer, but the swells were big and damaged, in effect, the aircraft's tail. But he managed to get aboard in the pitching boat with the precarious flag and was ferried to the battleship. He then handed the flag over to Halsey's aide, Lieutenant Commander William J. Ketchell. Fellow officers said they were amazed Bremer had gotten there so fast. That night, he had a steak dinner. The next day, the Missouri steamed into Tokyo Bay, anchored where Perry had in 1853. Planned was to fly the flag from the mast, but when the bag was opened, there was a note from the Annapolis Museum saying it was too delicate to be flown. So it was put in a framed glass case and placed on the ship's bulkhead where everyone could see it. 3 days later, September 2nd, 1945, officials assembled on the Missouri's deck to sign the instrument of surrender. Hundreds of reporters and photographers were present. Sailors crammed every vantage point on board, Bremer among them. He had delivered the flag. He had done his duty and completed his 9,000-mile mission.
The postscript to that story is that there was a sheet covering the fragile flag to protect it. Nobody wanted to be the one to remove it and damage the flag, so in the frame, the flag actually ended up backwards, something you can see reflected in the display aboard the battleship Missouri if you have a chance to visit it in Pearl Harbor. Our final words today come from that ceremony this week on the Mighty Mo. Admiral Samuel J. Paparo is the commander of the Pacific Fleet. His remarks included this special recognition of those who made the surrender possible, as well as an assignment for the rest of us.
To our veterans of the Second World War, and indeed to all veterans everywhere, we thank you for your unselfish and your heroic service more than 7.5 decades ago. Your service exemplifies the greatness that we've come to know and to expect from the armed forces. Your legacy of honor, courage, and commitment, it lives on in our sailors, Marines, soldiers, airmen, Coast Guardsmen, and civilians who support security, peace, stability in this vast maritime region and beyond. The next generation, those young people whom I've cited, the young people manning the ships and the aircraft all around us, must take up the mantle of our ethos against the challenges ahead, wherever in the globe it leads them. The nation and the naval services need them as much today as our nation needed the heroes of the Second World War. As the events of World War II pass further into history, we must continue to reflect on and never forget what it took to get to the 2nd of September, 1945.
That's what we try to emphasize each week here on Hometown Heroes. That is what this program is all about. Admiral Samuel Paparo, commander of the Pacific Fleet, at this week's commemoration aboard the USS Missouri for the 76th anniversary of the end of World War II. Next week, we'll be back with one veteran story from start to finish. It's a veteran who survived the Battle of the Bulge. Thank you so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you once more that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.